This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code. A lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X. We just dropped our Pride 24 collection. Queer founded, queer run, and creating size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. So you feel comfortable in your own skin. Visit TomboyX.com to shop.
Hello and welcome to Savor, a production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and today we have an episode for you about the semi-fictional foods of Pan's Labyrinth.
Yes, and if you've seen that film, then you know there's some intense subject matter to be discussed.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I suggested this topic because, you know, it's October. Mm-hmm. Even more people than usual are filling their brains with horror films. And I was like, oh, man, what if we did a fictional foods with some kind of horror property? And my first thought was The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
And Annie was like, so you're just going to talk about alcoholism?
Yeah. And the little sad... frozen cabinet they have.
And the sad frozen pantry. Yeah.
I was curious.
I was like, okay, I see you. And I don't know where I got Pan's Labyrinth from, honestly. Like, I was just kind of going through, because I almost wouldn't, I mean, it's a film with many strong horror elements, but mm-hmm. it's not usually categorized strictly as a horror film.
Right. Kind of a dark fairy tale with historical elements that are sad.
Yeah, which to me, I don't know. Like to me, Guillermo del Toro is pretty much always a horror director, no matter what precisely he's doing. He's really leaning in that direction. And I think that part of why it's not categorized as a horror film is the reluctance among some academics and film critics to recognize genre fiction as like good ever. Mm-hmm. So they're like, oh, well, I liked this, so it can't possibly be a horror film. It's a dark fairy tale.
Yes. We just did an episode about this on Stuff I've Never Told You, where
we were
talking about elevated horror and what does it mean and why is it a thing. And a lot of it is people just don't want to say they like horror.
Right.
Yes. So... a lot to unpack there. I saw Pan's Labyrinth when it came out because it was very critically acclaimed.
Mm-hmm.
It got a lot of buzz, as they say. So I saw it when it came out. I think I was pretty youngish at the time. Who knows? But it disturbed me. And I hadn't seen it again until this. I rewatched it for this episode.
Oh. Yeah, I think I must have seen it at least one other time. Yeah, because I remember seeing it in theaters and being, yeah, like very kind of racked about it. And really liking it and wanting to watch it again, but never quite coming around to like a really good time to do it. And so it's certainly been like 10 years or something like that since I've watched it. And it was really, really interesting getting to revisit it and see all of the effects that they were using and all of the themes that I've gotten to watch Del Toro use in some of his later works. So,
Yeah, and that's interesting to me that the food stood out enough to you that even though you hadn't seen it in a while, it was a suggestion. Let's talk about this. So,
well, if you've seen it, then I'm sure that you know, like, one of the main things we're going to be talking about is that heckin' dinner with the pale man. It's just it's very striking. And the actual scene, the actual depiction of the food in the scene is so short, but it's quite memorable.
It is. All right. So I guess that brings us to our question.
Oh, it certainly does. Yep.
Okay, here we go. Pan's Labyrinth. What is it?
Well, Pan's Labyrinth is the English language name of a Spanish-Mexican film, original title El Laberinto del Fauno. It premiered in 2006 and was written and directed right by Guillermo del Toro. And we've talked a lot about fairy tales on this show. We've done readings of a few of them. And this story is both a fairy tale and depicts very real historical events, if a fictionalized, stylized version of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there are two threads to the plot. One follows an 11-year-old girl named Ophelia and her pregnant mother as they arrive in a countryside military camp in post-Civil War Spain. Ophelia's father had died during the war, and they're settling in with her stepfather for his baby's birth. He's a captain in the military and stationed there to root out guerrilla activity in the woods. He's a cruel, stern man with little regard for Ophelia or her mother. His unborn son is all he seems to care about, not that he's even sure of the sex outside of his own, you know, arrogance. Times are lean, and the military and government are hoarding what little food and medicine are in the area. And the rebels are trying to help the locals. And one of the rebels, a woman named Mercedes, works sort of undercover as the head of house at the camp, like the head servant. Mm-hmm. Things go poorly in this plot thread. The other thread is a fairy tale that may be real or that Ophelia may have concocted. That she's really the lost princess of a magical kingdom, and that a faun has come to give her three trials to see whether she's worthy of rejoining her immortal family. So she must face fearsome monsters and protect the innocent and save her baby brother. Things also kind of go poorly in this thread. Sort of the theme of the film.
Yes, which we were talking about when I was trying to think of, like, Spanish, Mexican horror movies, and everyone, I was like, ooh, but that's pretty grim and sad. Ooh, that's pretty grim and sad.
I'm going to get into a little bit of why that is in just a second. First, a note on Del Toro. He was born in Mexico in 1964 into a deeply Catholic family, although he is a lapsed Catholic. He frequently works in genre fiction, some of which does indeed explore similar historical themes of authoritarianism. But we are ostensibly a food show.
So we say.
Almost every episode we have to remind ourselves.
Yeah.
food and various difficulties with it are a really key part of this film. Characters are constantly eating or drinking or struggling to do so. In the real world, there's daily cooking to be done, rations to distribute, feasts to impress with, nausea to cope with, and alcohol as a pleasure and as a painkiller. In the fairy tale world, there's tricks to be played and entrapments to avoid surrounding food and eating, and always the fear of being eaten by the monsters. More specifics on all of that in a little bit. But there's a lot of metaphor that can be drawn between the food and the anxieties surrounding it in the real and the fairy tale worlds. And okay, the Spanish Civil War and the fascist dictatorship of Francisco Franco afterwards were really terrible times in history for a lot of people. The war only lasted from 1936 through 1939, but Franco ruled from then until 1975. And hundreds of thousands of people were killed, partially in mass exterminations by the nationalists under Franco. Exterminations of people deemed socially undesirable for one reason or another, including people of religions other than Catholic, gay people, leftists of various walks. It's called the White Terror. And the extent of this is still uncertain today. But like it's thought that like tens of thousands of people still lie unknown in unmarked graves. Just this year, 2022, a virtual museum opened and new laws were passed in Spain to help untangle the history there. And especially in the decade or so immediately following the war, there was a lot of famine. There was this 3-year drought that did not help. A lot of the farms and the people who worked them were destroyed or displaced. It's sometimes called Spain's Years of Hunger. There was a ration system in place from the late 30s until the early 50s, but it was insufficient and rife with corruption. Research into people's diets indicated that no one was getting enough to eat. Literally, no one they studied was getting an appropriate daily caloric intake. And what they were getting was like over 50% calories from bread. It was a huge source of anxiety for many people, and malnutrition was very rampant.
Yeah. And I know we've talked about this in a couple of episodes, and I think that war and conflict, every episode we've done, has some instance of war, conflict. Here was the people who were suffering, who didn't have enough food, and what came out of that. So yeah, it would have a huge impact on the culture, the films that are getting made around these ideas.
Oh yeah, yeah, and the stories that you tell and how you deal with those anxieties. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I do love about genre fiction, and perhaps specifically horror, is that it's such a wonderful place to explore anxieties like that.
Yeah, yeah, especially like if you're trying to deal with something that is so tragic and terrible as this.
Yeah.
And you don't want people to turn away because it's not a fun topic. But horror is a way you can explore it, and it's still not a fun topic, but at least like you're having that conversation, and I think more people are more willing to engage in it in that way. But that's my opinion. Well, what about the nutrition?
Oh no. Oh dear. don't eat genre depictions of Francoist fascism.
Yeah, I think I can get on board with that one. No silly follow-ups from me. We do have some numbers for you.
Oh, we do. The film got a relatively limited release, but was very well accepted. It's certified fresh at 95% on Rotten Tomatoes. Very good. And the year that it came out, it was on the top 10 lists, like top 10 movies of the year, of at least 35 major publications.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As of 2016, it was still the fifth highest grossing foreign film in U.S. history. So that was 11 years after it had come out. And it was nominated for a glut of awards, pun intended after the fact, but, you know, let's roll with it. At the 79th Academy Awards, it won 3 for art direction, cinematography, and makeup. But it won across all categories with various organizations over the next year or so.
Yeah, it's very, very visually arresting. It's still, when I was watching it, I was like, still holds
up.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, okay. Yep.
Yep, that's beautiful and very upsetting sometimes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get into more of that. But first, we have a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressing, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X. We just dropped our Pride 24 collection. Queer founded, queer run, and creating size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. So you feel comfortable in your own skin. Visit tomboyx.com to shop.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. One of the thoughts that I had while I was watching this time around is like, goodness my gracious, this film is not light-handed.
No.
it's pretty straightforward. Like, as much as it's, you know, couching things in metaphor, it's very direct. And one of those things I realized, like, the very setting of the main events of this film is evocative, because the military camp is set up in this old mill. It is literally replacing a means of making food with a means of making war.
Yeah. Yeah. And it feels kind of, is trivial the right word? I don't know. I kept thinking of the Hunger Games. A lot of the conversations we had when we did the Hunger Games are very relevant to this as well. And obviously, the Hunger Games is totally fictional. Still has, like, real-world foods, but, like, a future dystopia.
Sure. Although, right. I can't help, like the reading that I was doing about the famine in the country immediately following the war was so reminiscent. Like, I have to think that Suzanne Collins did research into stuff like post-Civil War Spain when she was especially writing the prequel. Mm-hmm. It was just very, very, very similar and very upsetting.
Yeah. Yeah. And as we talked about in that Hunger Games episode, in Pan's Labyrinth, food is often depicted as a source of power. Mm-hmm. Several scenes show those who are in power feasting. And these feasts are often made by the lower class. They're supplied by the lower class. And that is why, while the lower class is like struggling and starving, they're feasting off of what they have done. Yeah.
What they have taken from them. Sure.
Exactly.
In just one example, at one point early in the film, two locals are captured by the captain's men and questioned for being potential rebels. It turns out they're really probably just farmers who were hungry and out hunting rabbits, but they're murdered for having guns and being out at night.
Right. And then there are also more fantastical elements illustrating the power of food. For instance, Ophelia, there's a scene where she's able to defeat this big toad.
This big noxious toad that's living under a fig tree and poisoning it slowly. Mm. Yeah.
Yes. She's able to defeat it by feeding it stones, which acts as like a purgative. It rids the toxin from the tree so that it once again can produce fruit. And this is all after she asks of it, "Aren't you ashamed of staying down here eating bugs while the tree dies?" Mm-hmm. And much of this food and its power serves as a symbol of, what was going on during the Spanish Civil War and fascism, when Vidal, acting as a symbol of the fascist government, hands out...
The captain. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Sorry. Yeah, when he hands out ration cards... He's controlling the source of food and therefore is in the place of power and is telling you that you're very lucky that they're so kind to give you these ration cards.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. We don't have to do this. mm-hmm. And then there are a lot of scenes around. So Mercedes works in the kitchen, works with a lot of other cooks. And there are a lot of scenes around that I found interesting. And especially like, them being sort of at the mercy of the higher-ups, like getting blamed for the burnt coffee, getting blamed for the rabbits that are too young to be cooked, these demands for this lavish food that isn't available, and then kind of the, like, gossip that's going on in the kitchen about, like, oh, they eat like pigs and just this... It being a space of kind of this... smaller rebellion of talking about like, look what they're doing. We see what's happening here. Mm-hmm. An early scene shows the captain talking about rations, like olives in a very smug manner. Huh. And then, they have the like well-off circle and his circle dividing them. And when they do hand out the rations, they call it like the daily bread in Franco Spain. Are very like, ooh, thrilled by it.
it's very oof. It's very like military dudes yelling at you, basically implying that you should be so grateful about this pittance of food that they have spoken with amongst themselves as knowing is insufficient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In another small act of rebellion, Mercedes does bring some food and rations out to the rebels. A little bit of disobedience in there. Yeah. Some cheese, some brandy, some tobacco.
Mm-hmm. And there are several scenes that I personally thought was like, ooh, this is something where it felt to me where I was picking up on like the dangers of cooking, like especially with Mercedes, she has this knife and she keeps like wiping it off in her apron. And I was like, oh, that's gonna come back.
It's a Chekhov's paring knife for sure.
Still. And then like there's a lot of stuff that felt evocative to me around like the death around cooking when it comes to cooking meat or preparing meat or the flip side of kind of the life-giving. You know, you killed this animal, but it's feeding people. And the same with milk. Like, there's a pretty particular scene where Mercedes is milking a cow. And I was like, there's a reason this was put in here.
yeah. And giving the milk directly to Ophelia. And it being a very kind of warm and comfortable and earthy moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the fawn... himself and the some of the fairies are shown eating as well. They eat this little scrap of jerky that looks real gross and and real suspect to me. I'm like, is that made of people? Like what? I'm kind of tearing at it pretty savagely. I'm like, okay.
I did enjoy that aspect of this movie of the kind of because so many fairy tales we grow up with or the Disney-fied version, and when you go back to the original, you're like, ooh. And I feel like this was kind of going back to like, oh yeah, fairies, maybe they eat people, I don't know.
Yeah, they're a little scary. But yep, watch out. They might be lying to you, you're not sure.
Yes, something could be going on. Which, speaking of, one of the key pieces of food, or not, it's not really food, but something that requires food in this, is the mandrake root. Mm-hmm. That Fawn gives Ophelia in order to heal her pregnant mother. And so Ophelia puts the root under her mother's bed and she feeds it like drops of blood and milk. However, when her stepfather discovers it, he is disgusted. He goes to destroy it, but before he can, Ophelia's mother convinces him, like, give us a moment alone. And she tells Ophelia, essentially, the real world isn't fair and magic isn't real. And then she throws the magic root into the fire and collapses in pain as it burns, as if she's somehow connected to it.
Yeah.
And that kind of struck me as this conversation we've had before of, like, looking down on these, on traditional, long-trusted remedies where they just are like, oh, this is gross, this is wrong.
Yeah, this isn't modern. It must be incorrect and silly. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was just heartbreaking to have this where Ophelia is trying to help her mom and be told, like, the real world sucks. Magic isn't real.
Yeah, suck it up. Yeah.
It's useless.
You need to grow up because this is never going to help. And then kind of immediately eating her words in that second that she destroys that thing, she starts having a much worse time.
Yes. And notably, the mandrake does kind of look like a child. And she...
like a baby. Yeah.
A baby. And the mother is pregnant. So it's... I felt pretty symbolic on the nose.
Yep. Like,
yep. Gotcha.
Yep.
But I think this brings us to the centerpiece.
Oh, yeah. Hoofda.
The pale man's meal. Yeah, it is. This is a very, very striking scene. So it's like this long table in an empty room, other than the pale man and Ophelia and her fairies in her little handbag. And on the table are just like all these fruits, all these drinks, and most of them are in shades of red. A lot of them are kind of like leaking red liquid.
Yeah.
There's ham and bright red caviar and jello, like just all of these like shades of pink and red. Other things in there too, but mostly that color palette.
Yeah, like black and rust and red and pink. As strawberries and slices of oranges, blackberries and raspberries, black and red currants, pomegranates and cherries, wine, all of this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a very saturated scene.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the head of this table is this monstrous pale man who doesn't seem to have any eyes and who is unmoving for a large portion of the scene. And Ophelia has been warned to not eat anything on the table.
Right. And if you haven't seen this movie, you've probably seen...
Yeah.
That's the image you've seen, is the pale man. So above this table are these frescoes that depict the pale man eating children.
Oh, yeah. Just gobbling them right up. Yep.
And so it feels very clear that the meal represents temptation. Was specifically designed to lure in children. And especially children who are hungry, which is something that comes up in fairy tales all the time, of like this hunger of children.
Yeah.
We talked about it in our Hansel and Gretel episode.
Yeah, and in our Goblin Market episode.
That's right.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, so Ophelia was told, like, don't take any part of the food. It was one of her trials. But she gives in and she eats two grapes. And I think in a lot of things I read, it's supposed to be like the pale man's eyes. So she eats these two grapes and then he's able to put his eyes in his hands. I'm making a hand gesture you can't see, but you
it's
know.
The pale man, it's the pale man hand eye gesture. When she comes in, his eyeballs are sitting on a plate in front of him. And then he just pops them right in the palms of his hands and he's like, oh, I can see now. Great.
Yeah. It's almost like, you know, by giving in, by partaking in this food, which she needed and wanted, she's giving him that power that we were talking about, that the kind of power that food has. And it does, this scene does echo another scene in the real world where the captain and his cohorts have this luxurious meal. They're toasting to each other. And over the whole meal is hanging over it is this suffering and lack of food available for others as they're just like,
yeah,
feasting.
Yeah, because at that dinner, at that feast, they're discussing cutting rations for the locals. Mm-hmm. And like the food on their table doesn't appear fancy, certainly not fancy the way that the Pale Man's dinner does, but is very plentiful, you know, potatoes and beans and roast chicken and red wine and those two rabbits roasted.
Yup. Uh-huh. That really, that burns.
Yep.
Mm. Oof, oof. Mm-hmm. And there is a history of using scenes of feasting, often over-the-top, lavish feast. I mean, even, like, in our real-world history, we've talked about that plenty. But in our fiction, like, there's so many examples I could think of. But you have those, like, gross mouth sounds. You have, like, the snapping of the bones, the inhaling, the sucking sounds, the, like, dribbling mm-hmm. of juices. Mm-hmm. Often the juices are red. And that is juxtaposed with poverty and death. And then also just, like, depicting such a gluttonous feast as an evil temptation. Like, oh, this is so bad.
Yeah.
It did remind me of the scene from Return of the King when...
Oh, sure.
Yeah, Denethor is, like, going to town, feasting alone. The sounds and the juices. And
yeah.
It's, like, cut against his soldiers going out to die while he's just... eating, like consuming.
Yeah.
And then I bought a lot of really in-depth essays about this that fascinated me, but kind of the whole idea of like in this movie of losing Ophelia, losing her innocence and this fairy tale kind of being, you know, her childhood innocence, trying to hang on to that and then it getting destroyed. And when the Pale Man, after she eats two of the grapes at this feast, he takes two of the fairies that she has with her and eats them.
Really gorily, yeah.
Yeah, and it just felt like that was a key moment of, oh, you made this mistake in heavy quotes, and you're going to lose this piece of, like, childhood innocence, maybe.
Yeah, like, the evils are real. You are not safe. This is what reality is like. And I would say that the Pale Man himself is a really terrifying depiction of hunger. You know, he either can't or won't eat this feast that's in front of him, but instead waits for children or for fairies to devour. And like physically, he's got this fatty skin that's hanging in loose folds all over his body, but the rest of his body is so thin, so like impossibly emaciated with this swollen belly. And oh, it's it's really upsetting.
It is.
Good show. Good show, everyone involved. Good show, Doug Jones. You're terrifying, sir.
Yes. Yes, I am scared. You have done an excellent job.
Yep, that's the actor who was portraying the fawn and also, or the movements of the fawn and the Pale Man in this film. Yeah.
And then I guess we need to talk about grapes.
Yep. Yep, because why grapes, right? Like, you know, there's this table is just bursting with like towering pies and roasted squash and roasted crabs, that ham that's studded with the pineapples and the cherries. But it's these grapes. There's this platter of this bright red fruit with the cut open pomegranates and these grapes, and they're huge and they're cold. You can tell because they're kind of sweating, and she just can't resist them.
Yeah, and I feel like the use of grapes just brings up so much for me. But, you know, like the temptation of the forbidden fruit, Bacchanal. I feel like a lot of times when I think of grapes, I see those kind of Greek paintings where gods or angels or what have you are eating grapes. And it's painted as like...
So luxurious.
So luxurious. Someone will feed them to you. Like, just the height of luxury. And then... I do think fruit is often used in fairy tales. Like, you have the poisoned apple of Snow White, just for one example. And then again, a lot of people have written about how this also represents the loss of innocence. And I found a specific paper that was about menstruation.
Oh.
And grapes. And I was like, well, I guess I'll come back later for stuff Mom never told you. I don't think this is a saver rabbit hole, but I'll come back. But yeah, it was interesting. And the way it was shot, Ophelia was looking. She wasn't looking at the pale man. The fairies are telling her, like, don't do it. Don't do it.
Yeah.
And she's eating them and just, like, she's a child and she's hungry.
She is a kid and she probably hasn't had something. I mean, like, fresh fruit in that kind of situation is luxurious. It is a special treat. And especially, you know, like thinking about refrigeration and how rare that was in those days, and especially in lean times when, you know, you don't always have power everywhere and stuff like that. And so, like, she probably hadn't had something that sounds as simple as a refrigerated grape in years, maybe in her whole life, because she's 11 years old. It's only 5 years after the war ended. You know, like she probably doesn't remember a time before war. She probably doesn't remember a time when she had as much fruit as she wanted to eat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know I said this earlier, but that, to me, goes back to that point of, like, if you're controlling the food, then you have the power. Because when she ate the grapes, she was hungry. She was a child. But in doing so, she did give, or her power was taken from her, and it made the pale man, like, wake up. He's able to see. So I just think, like, that whole idea of, if you are the one controlling, like, who gets food, how much food, then it, like, we can't blame her for not being able to resist, right? But
even, you know, even though we've seen her do incredibly brave, selfless things for the rest of the film, you know, in that moment, she was just a hungry kid. And, you know, and it's not evil.
No, it was just used against her.
The whole film really is about, you know, innocence and evil, and about bravery. Yeah, the bravery to do the right thing, even when that's going to cause some trouble for you. Even when you have direct orders to do the wrong thing. And that's just a really clear example of that, type of metaphorical visual. It's also a story about stories, about the power of stories, and how the same way that an authoritarian will try to control you through hunger, they'll try to control the narrative and who gets to narrate. And you see that again and again through this film, about, you know, Ophelia's mother fretting that she's wasting too much time reading books and thinking about fairy tales, and that it's not realistic and that she needs to grow up. And at that feast in the real world, you see the captain speaking down to Ophelia's mother. She tries to tell this kind of romantic story about how they got together, and he mocks her. He turns to the ladies who are there, and he's like, "Man, isn't she so quaint? Like, she really thinks that this kind of thing is amusing. Isn't that adorable?" And then when someone else at the dinner proceeds to tell kind of a story about the captain's father, about how he died, the captain denies it, even though this is clearly exactly what happened. That his father died at a certain time and broke his watch, and, you know, had instructions for the watch to be given to his son so that he would always know what time his father died. And he carries around this heckin' watch the whole movie and is obsessed with it. And the last thing that he does, because good does win in the end, really, in both the fairy tale and in the real world in this film. The last thing that the captain does is ask that the rebels give his son, the baby boy, Ophelia's little brother, this watch and tell him who his father was and what time he died. And the rebels cut him off. And they're just like, "Y'all, he ain't even gonna know your name." And that's it. And I love that. I love that they have, re-seized the means of narration. They've re-seized the means of production, of food, of welfare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really, really good. And we didn't even talk about, because I was also struck by the captain. He gets the slash on his face and he keeps trying to drink.
Oh.
And yeah. It clearly hurts him. And he keeps trying to.
But he keeps drinking alcohol, yeah. Whiskey or brandy or something like that. And, oh, it's so gnarly.
It is. It really is.
That was the thing that very much struck me, that this go-through, is how gory things get in the real world, and how, even though things are scary in the fairy tale world, they're never, I don't know, just that juxtaposition between the horror of fairy tales and the horror of getting your face slashed open and trying to sew it back up yourself. Like, that's so wild. Oh, I don't think I had ever seen anything like that on film before.
Yeah.
Oh, heck.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really, if you haven't seen it, we've just spoiled like the whole movie for you. So sorry, but but maybe if you have seen it and want to be kind of upset but also dazzled, give it a revisit.
I love it. Great review. Yes. Do recommend it. I feel like we've gave it enough of a warning that it's kind of a downer. That sounds trite, but essentially, yeah, it's a
bit. Does. I don't know. I think it's hopeful in the end. I think it's hopeful that there are good people who are willing to do good things and help each other out.
Yes. And that I think also that your small actions can mean so much more than you thought that they did.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go, we have some listener mail for you, but before we get into that, Annie, I want to ask you, do you think that the fairy tale world in this film is real, or do you think Ophelia was making it up?
My knee-jerk answer is I've always assumed it was real. And I think that's the way that it was shot and the way that it was done. I'd never had considered before that maybe she was making it up. I don't want to say just making it up, but
sure.
Like
this
escape. I always thought it was real.
I always thought it was real too. And then I guess rewatching it, there are just a couple little hints where the captain can't see the fawn. Or where you're not sure, Ophelia had this magic chalk from the fawn that could let her open a door to wherever she wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And Mercedes sees one of these chalk outlines, but it's just a chalk outline. There's no door there.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are other hints, where, I don't know, like where did she get that mandrake root? It seems very big for such a small child to have come up with. And I did read an interview with Del Toro where he's talking about how that is his intent, that it was real. And so I don't know. I'm just curious. I think watching it, I really hoped that it was real and was really afraid that it wasn't.
Yeah. I think the way that the narrative was set up, the way it was shot, you were, at least for me, I was primed to be like, yeah, that's legit. Like,
yeah, that's happening. Yeah, that's totally, that's, yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I believe her over this guy.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what we have to say about Pan's Labyrinth for now.
I think it is. We do have some, as aforementioned, listener mail for you. But first, we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X. We just dropped our Pride 24 collection. Queer founded, queer run, and creating size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. So you feel comfortable in your own skin. Visit tomboyx.com to shop.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with Listener.
Mail.
Like a maze.
Ah.
that was one we should have recorded. Oh, well. One day you'll get the video of what's going on behind these, whether you want it or not.
Oh, goodness.
Oh. Andrew wrote, Long time. Thanks again for always bringing a little sunshine into my day. Lately, my podcasts have been the audio equivalent of doom scrolling, so I very much appreciate your show. Well, this episode, I don't know, but thank you. Andrew continues, I'm a few weeks behind and just listened to your Dill episode and had two thoughts. Lauren made mention of Ukraine at the top of the show, and I was immediately reminded of a nearby brewery that recently released a beer in support of Ukraine. It was on the lighter side and was brewed with sea salt, sunflower seeds, and dill. Weird on paper, but definitely translated well into an enjoyable beverage. Herbed beers can sometimes be overwhelming, but this one was very well balanced. However, it caused quite the halitosis. Two, peanut butter and pickle sandwiches came up during the listener mail portion of the episode. To my abject horror, my wife actually makes peanut butter and pickle sandwiches occasionally for her lunch or for an afternoon snack and claims to enjoy them. She will smear on the peanut butter, put a dill pickle spear on the side of the bread, and fold it in half. She claims the texture of the pickle adds some level of sophistication, but I will never be touching one of those things. All caps, never.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I hope this doesn't get me on your bad side, but I feel like I could enjoy that.
I mean, I think that you would enjoy peanut butter in no matter. I don't think, like, not even mayo really dissuaded you from enjoying peanut butter.
It's true. Oh, no, now I have a craving. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Luckily, I have a ton of peanut butter. Not so many pickles. But I can fix this.
You can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this beer sounds delightful, I think.
It does. It does. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever had dill in a beer. But, oh, I'm so into that. Shad and Lauren wrote, we are reaching out to say hi and to share some fun tidbits from this past year's adventures and fun coincidences between episodes and where we happened to be visiting. Our reaching out has been on my to-do list for a while, but moving, starting new jobs, traveling, and celebrating our daughter Grace's college graduation, amongst other life events, has kept us on our toes all year. I'm on my first work trip since 2020, and as I sit in the hotel room awaiting my 6:30 a.m. alarm, I thought now would be an ideal time to reach out again. Here we go. We visited Palm Springs back in March, and lo and behold, I listened to your episode on date shakes on the flight. Little did I know that 2 days later, we'd be driving through Date Valley on our way up to Idlewild and to the Pines and Snow. So crazy, I know. The shakes are good, but the views from the mountains were better. This summer, we took our parents out to Sonoma and shared with them our love for wine tasting. After surviving 4 days with both sets of parents, plenty of wine tasting and catching up, we dropped them off at San Francisco Airport and did another week of road tripping and seeing friends from Sacramento to Los Angeles. During one of those long, crazy drives in the Central Valley, we listened to your episode about Pismo clams and the Monterey clam industry. 2 days later, we were in Monterey Bay. We had a marvelous lunch on the pier at Sandbar and Grill, saw some sea lions, found my new favorite hot sauce, the pepper plant. The stuff is amazing. Go buy some. I cannot even recall when we were listening to your episode on jerk chicken, but regardless, it brought back a rush of memories of finding the best jerk chicken cart in New York City. Oh, which I did. It's on 56th and 3rd Avenue, and the chicken with oxtail gravy and rice is the best cart food I've ever had. Now that I remind myself it's been 5 years since I last ate some, I need to make time to get back there and see if they're still there. Also, happy one day early, happy jerk chicken day. It's now on my calendar because of you two. And no, I did not plan on this timing. Another episode that spurned a food experience is when Annie waxed poetic about butter beans. I was like, wait, we eat those pretty regularly, thanks to Rancho Gordo, and I just happened to listen when I was in the mood to make some hummus. Lo and behold, butterbean hummus was now in our bellies. Those legumes make even better hummus than, dare I say, garbanzo beans. And, well, you don't have an episode on it yet, but if you are in search of a road trip and want to research bourbonism, you need to head to Louisville. I hope it's on your radar, and if not, I'm happy to write another diatribe worth of info about the city, the food, and, of course, bourbon. Thanks for sticking with me, making great shows, and I do apologize for the long-winded email. Plus, we are back in Atlanta later in November to see friends and eat our way through more of the amazing restaurants on Annie's map. Thanks again for sharing.
Yay! I'm glad that map is getting some use.
Oh, always. Yeah, yeah. Oh, goodness. That's a great map. Oh, heck. Okay. Congratulations on your daughter's college graduation.
Yes.
Heck
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, Palm Springs is such a weird city.
Okay, yeah.
Love that entire area. I have not been out to, like, Northern California in way too long.
Yeah. We need to fix that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, high on the list. High on the list.
It is. We also had a funny moment where we were like, have we done an episode on clams? We haven't done one, but we have talked about them in another episode. But this is a classic battle Lauren and I have. We're always like, didn't we do that episode already? No.
Yeah, no. Or we'll be 20 minutes into doing reading for an episode that both of us are convinced we've never done. Mm-hmm. And then we suddenly realize that we have done it because we're coming up with all of these links that we already have bookmarked.
Yeah. Like, there's no way I would have read this earlier, right? Maybe. Oh, if anyone knows about this jerk chicken cart, write in. We could confirm it. Saver Network.
Give us an update.
Yes.
Give us an update.
That does sound
homemade
delicious.
Homemade hummus. Always so good. Always so easy. I always forget.
I know. I've had a hummus craving lately. Mm-hmm.
Same. Yeah.
Also, we haven't been. So I always get in trouble for this. I can't remember if it's Louisville. I don't know how to say it. But anyway. But we did go to Kentucky and drink some whiskey.
Yes. we went and we got to talk with Eddie Russell. Mm-hmm. And A, he was delightful. Mm-hmm. And B, yeah, we did like a roundup of some of the food that we enjoyed while we were there, including hot brown. Am I saying the right thing?
I think so.
Yeah.
It was a lot. It was very good, but it was a lot of food.
Yeah. Oh, so much food all the time there. Oh, it was wonderful. Mm-hmm. So yeah. That was in the early days. That was way back.
That was when I was still driving around everywhere. Gosh. Oh my goodness. Times have changed, listeners. Uh-huh. Times have changed for any. But, Yes. Thank you to both of these listeners for writing in. If you would like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram @SaverPod, and we do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way. This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X. We just dropped our Pride 24 collection. Queer founded, queer run, and creating size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. So you feel comfortable in your own skin. Visit tomboyx.com to shop.
Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach.
Give me great food.
Tacos.
Give me adventure.
Hiking.
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise.
Give me some smiles.
Cheese.
Give me more beaches.
Beaches.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.